Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, details of a state government workforce crisis and why it matters. A view of the Ketanji Brown Jackson Supreme Court hearings through the eyes of an educator. And former Houndmouth front person, now flying solo in Lexington, Katie Tupin. First, since war broke out in Ukraine, we've been following the efforts of Valery Kaidanov and her Lexington family to rescue Valery's 84-year-old mother, who was trapped in their hometown, the now devastated eastern Ukraine city of Mariupol. Valery arranged an escape, and they recently arrived safe and sound in Lexington with quite a story to tell. Welcome back, Valery.
Thank you.
When we last talked, you were about to fly to Romania, so let's begin the story in its last chapter, and then we'll go back a bit and talk about what your mother has told you about her experience in Mariupol. So first, your trip to Romania, tell us about that.
So there were two places to pick up my mom. The original plan was to fly to Western Ukraine, where my sister lives. But then my son called me, and I promised them not to go to Ukraine, because they were bombing Lviv, which is the most western town, and seven people died right before my trip. So my ticket was to Poland, and I was supposed to, from Poland, make my way to western Ukraine. And then when they started bombing Lviv, my son called me and asked me not to go to Ukraine, and I promised them that I will not. And I exchanged my ticket to fly to Romania, because that part is a lot more quieter. And my sister actually lives 2 hours away from the border with Romania. So I flew to Bucharest, rented a car, and drove to Romanian-Ukrainian border, which was 400 kilometers away, about 7 hour drive. It's not the distance, but it's the tiny country roads. The drive was interesting. And I arrived to Romanian town Siret, and I was waiting for them at the border. They took a bus in Ukraine. They arrived in Siret, and Siret is full of volunteers, including I met the group of people from Alabama, American volunteers. So they arrived at Siret. I picked them up right on the border. And I wanted also, my sister lives in Ukraine and she was supposed to go back. And I just want her to have a little break. And she said that Romania was a lot better than Ukraine, because she could finally relax for at least a little bit. So we spent 1 week in Romanian Transylvania in the mountains. And then I took my sister back to Ukraine. And when I took my sister back to Ukraine, I was able to cross the border. So I came to Ukraine and just like spend an hour there, grab a taxi and send her back.
What was that like for you when your mother stepped off the bus, or when you first saw her?
Oh, I am a photographer. I couldn't resist, but I took lots of pictures, because the bus stopped on the other side of the border and I was not allowed to come too close. She saw me from a distance and she started running.
You spent some time before coming back to the States with her to kind of decompress and get comfortable, I suppose. And I'm just wondering, what did she tell you about her experience in Mariupol?
Actually, to my surprise, she probably has multiple levels of psychological defense. I don't know. She didn't seem traumatized, but maybe it's just on the surface. I'm sure there are more inside. She was telling me basically day by day what they did, how they lived. She lived in that apartment building for 60 years. She actually lived only in two places. She was born in Soviet Union, but now it's Russia. She grew up, graduated from school and college in Russia, and then when she married, she moved to Mariupol, and she lived there for 60 years. And our apartment building has six different sections, entrances. It's a four-story building, and in our section, there are eight flats. So every section has a little basement. So they stayed all together in the basement, 16 people, and they became a lot closer. Actually, when you live for such a long time in the same building, mm-hmm. of course she knows all her neighbors. Of course, they're kind of like friends. They're all close people. But when they lived in the shelter, basically you're becoming like a family. They were sharing everything.
Let's fast forward to her getting out of there. We've covered that before, but tell us again about her escape.
Actually, I'm still searching because I spent 45 days trying to look for volunteers or people who were trying to make money and helping people to evacuate. And I spoke to many, many, many people trying to get her out. But I suddenly get a phone call, and the people who called me send me the text message with the little note handwritten by my mom. Like, she asked me to transfer $100 for her to escape. So these couple, they're amazing people. I want to contact them. I think what they were doing, they were just going around the city trying to offer people to evacuate. They had one car and they could take four people at the time. But surprisingly, many people didn't want to leave. Many people, all they had was in Mariupol. Mm-hmm. And someone told my mom that these people appeared in our courtyard, and she talked to them, and the money that they asked barely enough for gas. So they were not making money on that escape. Uh-huh. I paid them more, and I shared their phone number with lots of my childhood friends. And they evacuated my high school friend. They evacuated the mother of my childhood friend. These are amazing people. And I sent them more money than they asked. And I paid for the evacuation of my childhood friend mother. And I probably will gonna send them more.
And so from there, they made their way to Berdyansk. Is that correct?
Yes, they drove her to Berdyansk, but they took not even the country road. They drove in the middle of wheat field, avoiding checkpoints. The official information was you cannot enter the city or you cannot leave the city. So they closed the city and they were looking for Azov fighters.
So how long was she in Berdyansk?
The plan was just like a couple of days, because from Berdyansk she could take organized evacuation on the bus. It never happened. So the next day, the buses didn't arrive. The next day, the same. And then 2 days later, the same people evacuated my childhood friend. And I connected them in Berdyansk. And my friend, who is younger, she's 60. My mother is 84. She very quickly made lots of connections and found the way to take a paid bus from Berdyansk to Zaporozhye. So they paid $50 for each person, got on this paid bus, and from Berdyansk, with the help of my childhood friend, they were able to make to the first Ukrainian town, Zaporozhye. They spent only one night in Zaporozhye. In Berdyansk, she ended up staying for 4 or 5 nights. First, she waited for my friend, and then they found the bus. And in Zaporozhye, they found actually the kids of my friend went online and found a private car. And that private car took my mom and my friend to Western Ukraine. My mom got off where my sister lives, and my friend went to Lviv.
And she is now here in Lexington.
Yes. Yes, and then I drove, I flew to Romania, drove to the border, picked her up, and we flew back to Lexington.
Will your mom now stay here in Kentucky with you and your husband, Gregory?
It's a tough question. I definitely will apply for a green card because we have been citizens for 30 years. And all these years, she was visiting me, but it was not reluctant. The plan was not to live here. That flat in Mariupol that she left behind, I would say, is like her sanctuary. She's 84. And for example, her archives, life archives, are not digital. She has lots of letters from my dad, even from us when we were in college. Back then, we were communicating through letters. She has lots of pictures. All her flat is covered by pictures of her when she was young, and my grandmother, and my kids, and us. And this is she does cross teaching. She did a lot of valuable works by cross teaching. It took years and years, and this is all she has. And she really hopes when she left Mariupol, our building was standing. So she really is hoping to come back to her life. I mean, we will get a green card and we'll see how it goes. With the green card, she can be traveling back and forth all the time. And but for right now, yes, she will stay with me and my husband. We have big house, all kids are gone. We're empty nesters, and she will stay with us.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you sharing your story with us, Valerie, and good luck to your family and to your mother, and we hope things work out well.
Thank you, Tom, very much. Thank you for having me.
Images of Valerie Cardano's mother arriving at the border between Ukraine and Romania are on our homepage at esweku.org. When it comes to government, many people tend to think less is more. The less we have to pay in taxes to support government, the more we get to keep for ourselves. But when you bring the focus down to a level of government that can really have an effect on your life, state government, less can be less. That's the conclusion of a report from the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. When compared to a rise in wages for private sector employees, state workers have not seen a meaningful pay raise in at least a decade. And as a result, those wages have since 2008 declined by 4% on average after adjusting for inflation. And this has had a very direct impact on vital state services. Dustin Pugel, a senior policy analyst at the center, and senior fellow Pam Thomas did the research, ran the numbers, and wrote the report, complete with charts and graphs to help us visualize what they've found, and they're here to help us wrap our minds around what they describe as a state workforce crisis. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having us.
And if you would just lay it out for us, where pay and benefits are concerned, what is the condition of the state workforce?
Sure. I think there's been a lot of conversation about workforce shortages over the last several months, but I think it's important to kind of think of the state workforce crisis is something separate, whereas the, you know, public sector is completely dependent on public revenue, and raises are completely dependent on the General Assembly. We've really gone, like you said, for over a decade now without a significant raise for state workers, and that's been sort of a boiling pot over time. And that, in addition to eroding health benefits, changing the state pension plan to be less generous, has really created a real crisis in not only attracting workers, but also retaining the workers we have. And so the result is that about one in five jobs that we could have in state government are unfilled now. And that's putting extra burden on social workers, on public defenders, on the folks who provide public benefits, and everybody else within state government. And really, I think, lowering the ability of the state to provide the services that we've asked them to.
And doesn't state law require 5% annual increments for all state employees?
It does. And the last time we did that was 2001.
That's a long time ago. How does the difference between public and private sector pay compare?
Sure. So the last time there was a really comprehensive look at similar workers within the public and private sectors here in Kentucky was 2008. And back then, public sector workers were paid about 22%. Less than their private sector counterparts. When you factored in public benefits, which tend to be a little more generous, like health care and pensions back then, it ended up being about 6% less in total compensation. That has only gotten worse. Like you mentioned, when you account for inflation, state sector wages have actually dropped 4% since that time, whereas private sector wages have increased by about 13%. So pretty significant difference in pay back then has only widened And we're seeing the results of that now.
We're experiencing a highly unusual labor market these days. It's a real challenge to attract talent. And your report looks at the turnover rate and the state's ability to recruit new workers. How is this situation affecting the attractiveness of working for the public?
Sure. Well, you know, just to give one example of social workers, because I know that there's been a lot of discussion about their compensation lately. Up until recently, these social workers are making about $17 an hour, whereas in other areas of the economy, like or other employers like Target and Chick-fil-A, they're offering about $18 an hour, and the benefits are about the same. So what that means is that, you know, for social workers where they face a lot of really strenuous, stressful situations, they have to be highly educated in order to take those jobs. You know, some of these other positions just look more attractive. And so the result is that in 2021, about 44% of social workers had 1 year or less of experience. So we had supervisors who had maybe 2 years of experience overseeing people whose jobs are really to take care of the children of the Commonwealth in really tricky and dangerous situations.
In the report, you cite as examples of this decline in workforce what has happened to public defense, which is required by our state constitution, as well as such services as the state foster care and the adoption systems. Tell us more about that.
Well, the public defenders have a really unique place in the Commonwealth in that they employ more attorneys than any other agency in state government. And not only do they face competition for hiring people with outside entities, but they also face a lot of competition within state government. And the reason why is because for most state agencies, they might have a couple of attorneys. And so if you wanted to increase the wages for your attorney, it's pretty easy to do. You've got a few. Whereas in DPA, Department of Public Advocacy, an increase in salaries for them would cost a whole lot more because they are almost all attorneys. And when you look at the pay within state government agencies of the top paid lawyers, only two of them are with DPA, even though they have over 40% of the state government lawyers. So they suffer both from internal competition for people who want to continue to work for state government, but also from competition from outside. And they have caseloads that they have said numerous times in testifying before the legislature that are unconstitutionally high, that inhibits their ability to adequately represent their clients. And so when they have to make a choice between increasing salaries or having more attorneys, they always go for having more attorneys because of that caseload issue. Now, they did get some money in this budget. They did request additional money on top of the overall increase, which they did get, and that will help them. But it isn't going to get them to all the way they need to be. And one other area that I want to mention is Department of Juvenile Justice.
Yes.
Department of Juvenile Justice has had vacancy rates of over 33% for many years running, and they did an increase in salary a couple years ago, taking it up by 8%, which helped a little bit. But then they still had vacancies, and they actually ended up having to close a facility in Northern Kentucky because they didn't have enough people to staff it. And then they have to rely on other staff to staff it, and they have to rely on overtime, which creates a sort of a, you know, an effect that then people are burnt out because they're overworked. And their salaries are still very low, even with the increases. And as Dustin said earlier, when you compare it to the salary at Long John Silver's or McDonald's, the wages are the same and the risks are a lot higher. And then there's forced overtime. But when you think about what the ramifications of that are, these are services that have to be provided. And the state agency doesn't have control over the children that they're taking care of, just as DPA doesn't have control over the number of people that need defense. So there isn't a way to not do what they're supposed to do. And when they have not enough people to do it, they end up in extraordinary circumstances that aren't good.
What about public school teachers and public school staff, for that matter? What has happened to them?
School teachers is an interesting question because the money to fund education, public education in Kentucky, comes from a combination of state and local resources. And the teachers are actually hired by the local school districts. And one of the arguments that was made during the session about why the General Assembly did not provide an across-the-board increase for teachers like they did for everyone else is that that's a local decision. But in the report, we looked at what had happened to teachers' salaries over the course of the last 10 years. And what we have seen is there's a huge disconnect, I guess is the right word, between the salaries in some districts and others. And so, like, I think in Russellville Independent, teachers now, when you take inflation into account, are making 25% less than they did 10 years ago. In Fayette County, they make a little bit more than they did 10 years ago. But in almost all school districts, teachers are making less money, and their benefits, like everyone else's, have been eroded. In fact, they take another big hit in benefits starting at the beginning of this year with their pension plan. And they've had to pay more for health insurance, like all other state employees have. And there's already a teacher crisis in that there's a shortage. And that also applies to bus drivers and cafeteria workers. And, you know, the way that districts raise revenue has to do with their local property tax base. And what we've seen, especially in some of the Eastern Kentucky districts, is their bases have been eroding. So their ability to generate local revenue has been reduced. And so that puts them even in more compromising position. And so the General Assembly did say that, well, we've provided a lot more money in education, so they can do the salaries if they want. But I saw something the other day from Jefferson County that the extra amount of money that they got in order to do that would be about $7 million, and a 1% increase would cost $8 million. So, you know, you really need to think about, it's easy to say those words, but when you get right down to the nuts and bolts, the actual reality of it is that districts clearly don't have the money to do that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it a truth that state government work is a major employer in some Kentucky counties, many Kentucky counties?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the state sector, the public employees, they get about $1.4 billion every year in salaries, which is a significant amount of money when you look at the overall income of the state. So if you look at specific counties, though, like obviously Franklin County, where a lot of state sector workers live, it's almost a third of what their community brings in. So it's a significant economic driver.
What would have to happen to bring the state back into compliance with that constitutionally mandated 5% annual increment? And does the state have the money to make it happen?
Well, this year was actually a really good year for state workers. I think because the General Assembly realized this public sector crisis was so serious, they decided to make a pretty significant investment in pay raises. So in 2023, fiscal year 2023, starting in July, state workers will get an 8% raise, which is good, although if you look at inflation, that essentially just keeps up with where we were last year. So essentially, they're holding public employees harmless for their pay. In addition to that, they held aside enough to give the equivalent of a 12% raise next year, and asked that the personnel cabinet provide a report to kind of restructure the way that they compensate public sector employees, which is really important. I mean, just to try and keep enough people, some departments have changed salary schedules in such a way that, you know, supervisors make less than the folks that they're supervising in some cases. So the whole pay structure really needed an overhaul. And so I think that the General Assembly took a really important step in requiring that that happen to sort of unlock this 12% increase next year.
So somebody in the General Assembly is listening and hears this.
Yeah, I think so. And I credit, you know, a lot of the folks like the social workers who sort of rallied around this issue. I credit department heads for really speaking up about this issue. And I think, you know, in some ways that was really brave, because it's, I think, always a little bit risky to come before a committee and say, hey, we're having a hard time doing our job. And I think this session I heard more of that than usual. And the reasoning is, you know, when you can make as much at a job that's a lot less stressful, you know, I think people take them up on that.
And one thing I wanted to mention that I think is really important here, too, is the salaries in the judicial branch. And I meant to mention that earlier. It's a third branch of government. And the way that budgeting works is the judicial branch is in many ways kind of an afterthought. It's a separate budget from the executive branch and the legislative branch budget. And Chief Justice Minton has testified now for several years about how far behind Kentucky has fallen in comparison to other states, and just even really in comparison to other state agencies. And after they did the increases for the DJJ workers and the social workers, I went and looked at the salaries that were being advertised for state positions, and all of the lowest salaries were in the judicial branch of government, not the elected officials, but the people who help keep the court systems going. And in many cases, their salaries were, you know, $15 an hour or below. And the judges in Kentucky, too, the Supreme Court justices, I believe they're ranked 50th out of all of the states and territories in their comparative salaries. And that carries through down into the other courts, too. So our court system is very underfunded. And so when you think about the underfunding of the public advocacy department and the underfunding of the court system and the effect that that has on justice in the Commonwealth, it bogs everything down. And it also doesn't ensure that we get the absolute best people who would be able to do those positions.
It sounds like the bottom line is that progress has been made, but there's a whole lot left to be done.
Yeah, we're going to pay close attention to what that personnel cabinet report says, because we think that it will illuminate a lot of the real issues that you just can't see, you know, from the outside. And we're hopeful that the General Assembly will listen and follow through on their promise.
Do you know when to anticipate the release of that report?
It'll be at the end of the year.
Okay.
Well, and the other thing, too, about that is that 8% sounds like a lot, and it is. And 12% sounds like a lot, and it is. But when you've got 10 years of not doing statutorily mandated 5% increases, you have a lot of ground to make up.
That's a lot of catch up.
Yes.
That's right.
That's a lot.
All right. This is Dustin Pugel, Senior Policy Analyst, and Pam Thomas, Senior Fellow at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy in Berea. Thank you both.
Thank you.
The full report, authored by Pugel and Thomas, complete with those charts and graphs that can help you visualize the numbers, can be found on our homepage at esweku.org. Coming up after the break, the Supreme Court nomination hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson as seen through the eyes of an educator.
It was an incredibly teachable moment.
And for Lexington recording artist Katie Tupin, it's not all about music.
I'm not just a songwriter.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, reminding Kentuckians when it comes to electricity, safety is within your power. Be cautious around overhead or buried power lines, take care around downed power lines, and always teach children about electric safety.
And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The deeply partisan tensions brought to the surface during the recent Senate hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson continue to reverberate. Historian and pastor Gerald Smith updates his Eastern Standard series on racial justice and equality, discussing Judge Jackson's successful navigation of those often difficult hearings with Gaines Center Director Dr. Melinda Price, a University of Kentucky professor of law and humanities, and author of At the Cross, Race, Religion, and Citizenship, and the Politics of the Death Penalty.
Good afternoon, Dr. Price.
Hi, how are you? So I'm so happy to be with you. I've heard you on the radio, and I'm honored to be a part of the conversation you're creating over there at Eastern Standard.
Thank you very much. Well, as you know, on April 7th of this year, the United States Senate confirmed the nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. It was a bipartisan vote, as you know, 53-47, making her the first Black woman to serve on the court. What were your thoughts as you observed the nomination process? And secondly, did you observe any teachable moments that you found extremely important to share with your students?
Well, I guess I could start first on a personal level. You know, just Judge Brown Jackson and I are roughly the same age. I think she's a little bit older than I am. But we are a generation of young people who grew up in the shadows of the legal successes of Thurgood Marshall and benefited from them, Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP. So our lives, our very lives that we have lived as lawyers was made possible by the legal advocacy of Thurgood Marshall, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Charles Hamilton Houston, and all of those people who created the legal architecture for the limited equality that we experience now. So it's very exciting to go from all those years of Thurgood Marshall and to have now a Black woman on the court. as a lawyer, as a Black woman, as a direct beneficiary of the civil rights movement, it was very exciting. I always encourage my students to watch every Supreme Court nomination hearing. It is for them not just a lesson in how judges think about the law, but also how people think about judges. So it was an incredibly teachable moment for my students. Every one of them I have watched and discussed since I've been a law professor, I have discussed with my students. And one of the things that's very interesting about Judge Jackson, which made her hearing both probably slightly more robust than we have seen with some of the hearings we've had in previous years, is that she's a practicing lawyer. She has both tried cases and heard cases and made decisions as a judge. In her record of practice, if you added up everyone else on the Supreme Court, she has had more practice than almost every one of them added together. And that is meaningful because although I'm an academic, I know that there are limitations in the ways that I experience the law as someone who thinks about the law theoretical. And the Supreme Court has real world impact on the lives of American citizens. So it's important to have people who are engaged daily with the implementation of law, which is what legal practice is, to also sit and make some of these judgments that are so impactful to us all. So I always encourage my students to watch, but this one was particularly sweet to watch, to think about what it would mean for Thurgood Marshall to think about a lawyer like Ketanji Brown Jackson on the court.
Have the hearings always been so politically polarized?
Well, you know, I always remind my students that the hearings have always been political, but the polarization is relatively new. So it's a political process. She's nominated by the president, who's elected by the people. The Constitution requires that she is confirmed by the Senate, who are all elected people. So it's an inherently political process because it is engaged in by political people. Now, judges are not supposed to be as political, but we have seen dating back to the failed nomination of Robert Bork, to the contentious nomination hearings of Justice Clarence Thomas, to the hearings of Brett Kavanaugh. And we've also had a number of judges in rapid succession, which have emphasized the polarized nation of the American public. So we often had senators who were voted in by less than 60% of the Senate in past years. But it is really the sort of current moment where we see the kind of polarization sort of feeding how people feel about judges. I think it's important to remember that much of what we understand as the sort of conservative Republican political movement was born out of a backlash against what you and I might call Supreme Court successes. So Brown versus the Board of Education, Roe v. Wade, the expansion of rights for people who have been charged with crimes. To them, that drove people like Ronald Reagan, and the conservative movement was born out of what they saw as Supreme Court overreach. So when we watch Ketanji Brown Jackson being questioned by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, or the senators from Tennessee, what we're seeing is the full circle politics of what really grew in the 1980s out of a response to civil rights decisions.
Speaking of Justice Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill was a witness during his confirmation hearings in 1991. Of course, she's currently a law school professor. I read in an interview that she thought the credibility of the court was on trial and it was damaged during this process. What are your thoughts on that?
I would not say it's not just the credibility of the Supreme Court. It's the credibility of all courts. When we challenge the idea that somehow judges who make decisions within the norms of what other judges have done, and we treat those judges as outliers, meaning that they are acting somehow against what the law requires, it opens up for question all of the decisions that judges make that someone might not agree with. And today, that might be a discussion about those who are engaged in child pornography, But next, it could be something about how we think about the detaining journalists, or all of these sort of fundamental questions that are important to us. So I don't know if I would go quite that far, but every time we have one of these nomination hearings, certainly it is the one time in the life of a Supreme Court justice or any federal judge who all have life tenure, from not all of them, but the majority of them, have that job for life. It's the only time we get to see them questioned publicly. So we need to be mindful of the fact that some of this is about Judge Brown Jackson. Some of it is about the people who are questioning her, trying to set themselves up to make later arguments in the political space, which have little to do with her confirmation or how she will perform as a judge.
Do you think her confirmation is an indication that systemic racism no longer exists in America?
No. I think she's one judge who's made it to a very powerful court. If you look at, similar to Sonia Sotomayor and Thurgood Marshall, the impact of those judges was that they brought with them all of their lived experiences as people of color who have been historically underrepresented in the field of law and historically discriminated against or been the objects of state overreach, or where the state has gone too far in its power. And that impacts their judgments. This is also true, by the way, of Clarence Thomas, who came to visit the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law several years ago. And even he told a story about how his interest in the law grew out of the ways in which the state and discrimination was sort of unchecked in the South of his growing up. So I think that we have to be mindful not about whether this is the end of all the systemic racism that we have seen in the criminal justice system, but at least we have someone who is very familiar with this within her own community, her own life, and her own lived experience that might impact judgments that might lean in towards justice for those people who continue to find themselves caught up in these systems. Now, this is a conversation not just that can be had about race. We have also had this conversation about judges who have brought other kinds of identities to the court. So for instance, when Jewish Americans ascended to the Supreme Court, we began to see some substantial changes in how we understood religious freedom, in part because Jewish people have been a religious minority in this country and understood what it meant to have your right to the expression of your religion curtailed. And the same is true when we talk about women, and we can talk about Sandra Day O'Connor, and in her early years of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her work with the ACLU, anytime anyone with a new identity ascends to that court, it changes the conversation. It doesn't end anything, but it can change the conversation that could lead to positive strides for people of the communities to which they belong.
Did Justice Jackson's resilience encourage young Black professionals and women in particular as they pursue their careers?
Well, not just young ones, but some old ones, because, you know, I'm getting up there. I'm getting up there in years. You know, at the end, when she was being questioned by Senator Alex Padilla of California, she told this amazing story about her early years at Harvard and being down one day. And as she was walking across the Harvard yard, an older Black woman must have seen the look on her face and leaned into her and told her to persevere. And it was, for me, a reminder of the work that we do that's intangible. People like you, people like me who are in the university, we're students who may not see people like them. And sometimes we just have to lean in and give them a word of encouragement. And I think that in the same way that I grew up, and Gerald, you are a man of religion, and I grew up in Black Baptist churches that had pictures of Thurgood Marshall and John and Bobby Kennedy, there are going to be young people who are going to grow up with the image of Ketanji Brown Jackson and her words that we should persevere in the face of obstacles, of difficulties, of things that are too hard and seems like we may not overcome, that we just have to persevere. She is by far one of the most important images of power that we have seen rise in the years since those great successes of the 1960s civil rights movement.
That's Dr. Melinda Price, the William L. Matthews Jr. Professor of Law, and the John and Joan Gaines Professor of Humanities, as well as the director of the University of Kentucky Gaines Center for the Humanities. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Price.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm Dr. Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
Art in its many forms is everywhere you look and listen, and that includes the music of Katy Toupin. Rising to stardom alongside Louisville's Houndmouth, Katy has toured the world, played countless sold-out shows to tens of thousands of fans. There were multiple appearances on Letterman and Conan. In 2016, though, Toupin decided to follow a different path, leaving Houndmouth to migrate out west, but like many Kentuckians who leave for a time, returning. And now calling Lexington home. And that's where Lexington producer and recording engineer Dwayne Lundy caught up with her for the latest in his series, Depth of Field.
Katy Toupin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
So the natural place to start an interview with you is with Houndmouth and you leaving the band. But I am more interested in, and especially having had an opportunity to collaborate together, with you talking to us a little bit about the one-woman apparatus business that you're running, multifaceted with the music, podcasting. I just find it very inspiring.
So I'll tell you where that came from. So when I left my old band, I had all my eggs in one basket, right? That was just the Houndmouth basket, and that didn't work out so well. And so when I left, it was a really tough time because I just didn't have anything else. You know, I lost my identity. And one day I lost my job, my identity, everything. And I told myself I'm never going to be in that position ever again. And I realized I'm just this much more multifaceted human. I'm not just a songwriter. I'm not a person that I think would be content just touring for the rest of my life. You know, I needed to branch out into these other things. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been building lots of little things around me as an artist and me as a musician, but branching out and creating other things that bring me joy.
Do you feel that the diversity in that actually feeds your songwriting, which is obviously our relationship to you is mainly through song, you know, in your
Correct.
Performances. That do you feel like that helps that, or does have anything to do with it at all?
You know, I'm a little torn because sometimes I do feel my attention, if I put more attention into maybe songwriting, it might be serving the songs better because I do get distracted because I have all of these other interests. But I think at the end of the day, I'm happier. And being happier is going to lend to coming into writing songs from a better place.
Right.
Not a place out of just obligation and desperation. It's a place of, oh, this is fun. Let's do this.
So one of the most complicated things about being in the music industry from the artist side that I see from my seat is that the responsibility of the business apparatus, the marketing, along with all the creative, is so much now in the hands of the artist. And that's a lot to ask of you all. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You don't get a business degree at the same time you learn how to play a G chord. So when...
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, right? It actually should go hand in hand. Do you enjoy the social media aspect of it and the marketing side of it? It seems like that you sort of do.
Well, I don't know. I you know, it's a love-hate thing, social media. And it does go back to when I left the band. I didn't even know how I got paid, Dwayne.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know anything about the business. I didn't understand it at all. And so I had a few managers that kind of screwed me over after the band too. And so it was like, okay, like I need to learn all this stuff myself and do it myself. And it was just a matter of feeling empowered and taking the reins and being like, I can learn this stuff. I can do this stuff myself. It is a responsibility, you know, it's both sides of the brain kind of have to function.
Mm-hmm.
And I think fortunate because I am one of those people that can do both. And it does require a lot of self-discipline. You know, because I have to set aside time that says, okay, I'm going to be a creative person and work on my art. And then I have time set aside that says, I'm going to answer emails. I'm going to work on social media posts. I'm going to promote something. I'm going to, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So you did the nearly impossible. You convinced me that Blink 182 was actually a valid thing because I never liked that band at all. And to give people a little bit of a backstory, you hit me up and said, you know, would you maybe want to help out to record some Blink 182 songs? Anybody else, I would have probably just said no, but because I was such a fan of your voice and I had not had a chance to, we hadn't worked together before, I thought, okay, let's see. And then I was completely enamored with the very first song we did. You sort of proved, you know, the intelligence level of those arrangements and those melodies. And then, of course, you added your thing to it. But can you give the listener a little bit of a reason why you would even step into that territory?
Sure. So I did have the idea that a lot of these pop punk songs that might turn people off because that's not the genre of music that they listen to would appeal to that audience had the production and delivery been just slightly different,
right?
Because it was clear to me that the melodies are incredibly catchy and incredibly smart, and in particularly Blink 182 songs, so catchy and so smart. But I think the people that don't like that band are just turned off by the delivery and by the production. And so I was like, I'm going to do this. So I played an acoustic version of Adam's song, and I posted it on Instagram. Mark Hoppus reposted that video. Mark Hoppus is one of the band members of Blink 182, and he reposted the video on Instagram, and it got like 115,000 views in a day. And I was like, I think there's something to this. And so Mark is actually he has lymphoma, or he's in remission. So I decided that I would take all of these songs and any of the streaming from these songs, I would donate to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And so I kicked off a GoFundMe. And so this is a totally fan-funded, mostly fan-funded. Let's be like, some of it's coming out of my pocket.
Sure.
Because we got about $6,500. And there's a music video also for one of the songs. So it's mostly fan-funded. And it's just been a really fun thing because I got to prove my point and I got to be right.
Yeah.
And I really do enjoy and love these songs. And it's been really fun to revisit them because I was a fan when I was 12. I loved Blink 182.
Well, you did a tremendous job. Here's an example of one of those tracks, Damn It, from Blink 182, performed by Katie Toupin. I wanted to ask, especially as a dad of I've got a 20-year-old daughter, so much in the music industry has been very, you know, male-centric, and there's that history, and I think it's decently documented. I'm curious, though, to take this from another side, as to what you consider advantages of being a female in a relatively male-dominated industry historically. Or is there any?
That's a tough question, honestly, because I'm so prepared for the answer of like, how's it hard? And I'm like, I know exactly. Advantages. I mean, I think that you can offer a perspective that men can't. And I think a lot of women tend to be more naturally empathetic. So you can offer that more empathetic perspective. And I think that a lot of men have a sort of like, I don't know, like bravado, like macho kind of thing that can stand in their way. And women don't necessarily have that energy that they're trying to like maintain all the time. And so maybe there's a little bit more of a vulnerability that's more easily available to a lot of women. But I will say it is hard. It's hard being a woman in music. And I think that the women that last in this industry tend to be so much stronger than the men that are like long lifers, because it just beats the crap out of you.
Now that I know you better, one of the things that I've come away from our experience is the amount of time that you put towards health, mental, emotional, physical. And I've seen that really pay off, and it's something that's inspiring. Can you give me a little background on sort of how you landed in the particular place that you're at and what it was that got you to this place?
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. I'm sober. I'm almost 5 years sober. And so because I'm sober, I had to come up with lots of ways to cope that I was able to not do before. And so, you know, I do exercise almost daily. I get outside. This morning I did a visualization meditation. I listen to podcasts that are uplifting or inspiring and all kinds of stuff, because I think what we're putting in our brains via our phones and what we're subjecting ourselves to makes a difference in who you are and how you feel. And being conscious of that, especially now when like our phones are just so available, and then you get on Twitter and then everything's just negative, negative, and it's like, oh, this is bad. So you have to just make a conscious effort, I think, to take care of yourself, because I'm not necessarily a supernaturally positive person. I'm a positive person now, but I work really hard at it, and it's an ongoing practice. It's not, I'm good now. This is like, I have to take care of this stuff every day.
Looking into the crystal ball in the future, where do you see things headed for you artistically? I think one of the great things about the current state of the industry is there's far less ageism than there ever has been. And the creative opportunities and flexibility is far greater than it was before. If you could look out, where do you see things headed?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what I'm doing in the long term is everything I'm doing now, but on a grander scale. I don't have any desire to change course. I do lots of things. I do music. I do one-on-one coaching with people. I do this Camp Katie artist resource that I started. I do my podcast. I write screenplays. I do all these different things, and I want to do all those things just on a larger scale. But yeah, I think I'm doing it as the answer.
That's a good place to be. Katie Toupin, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a great privilege.
Well, thank you. This has been awesome. I love you, Dwayne. It's good to see you.
Good luck with everything, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
All right, we'll talk soon.
I'm Dwayne Lundy. This is Depth of Field on Eastern Standard.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog and official tail-wagging Eastern Standard greeter. Thanks to Paul Simon for Mother Child Reunion. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.